lot. There's been a lot of press. There's been a lot of participation from CPOs and the special districts involved. So that won't happen without public acknowledgement, without the city adopting a comprehensive plan amendment, establishing that urban services boundary, and the County of Washington adopting a comprehensive plan amendment. So that can't happen without public involvement.
Just a second. What about areas where the city of Hillsborough and Beaverton are fighting over them, and they both claim that they're in their urban services boundary?
But neither of them have an adopted urban services boundary.
So you said, you roll back the tape, this couldn't happen.
Portland has a policy of annexing within an established urban services boundary.
But we're not looking at Portland's policy. We have very little control over that when we talk about cherry stems or non-contiguous or anything else. We have to kind of work with things the way they are in the real world out there. And I assume that changing a policy is like a six-week process.
I guess what I'm suggesting is this, that the state might take a look at getting some commonality between a complex set of land use planning laws and a very complex set of annexation laws, because you're very clearly pointing out that there's a lot of variation and there's not very much commonality between them. So perhaps perhaps you're pointing to something
that's
taken
into
account.
Yeah, but if you do say they have to be contiguous, basically, and you limit the length of the cherry stem, I think we're coming a lot closer to complying with land use laws than we are just simply saying you can go as far as you want as long as you don't go outside your urban growth boundary.
Would you be so kind as to let me draw what I've been doing annexation for a long time. I've been doing it for 5 years. And so I can see a lot of different patterns potentially evolving, even with the type of legislation that you have here with 150-foot right-of-way requirement. Do you mind if I draw something on the board?
No, cherry stems aren't permissible in any place. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I guess I'm having some difficulty following all this testimony. Maybe you or the committee administrator could indicate to me what the problem is that this bill is supposed to be solving.
We're getting the drawing. Representative Edmondson, I think, outlined it in terms that the people are not adjoining the city of Eugene in the case. And basically, it's a Eugene, River Road, Santa Clara.
I understand the fact that
there are people that are out there, and for no other reason than the fact that the sewer may go by their place or close to it, they can find out that the property next to them is going to be in the city, and they don't think that that shows a logical pattern to annexation.
Is the problem the lack of a logical pattern, or is the problem that people don't want to be required to annex in order to get sewer service? If that's the problem, then maybe we need a different bill. But I'm trying to find out what the problem is that this bill is supposed to address.
Well, there are two things. One, some cities don't provide sewer service.
Right.
And they don't provide some other services like park service. So people may want to join the city for the ease of development more than any other one factor.
Is that a problem?
I don't think it's a problem. I think it's actually good, particularly where you have a fire marshal that does an inspection on buildings. I think that the fire marshal that does the inspection should be with the group that's going to provide the service. And so I don't see a problem for development purposes, but I do simply just, I'm sure some of these people that went in to the city of Eugene did it so they could market their property.
Well, maybe we'll discuss this more if and when we get to a work session on this issue, but I'm having a heck of a time, I think I'm following what people are telling me technically, but I'm having a heck of a time understanding why we're here listening to all of this. And that's, and maybe that will get clarified later on. Appreciate the, allowing me the interruption, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I can see a cherry branch happening instead of a cherry stem. If you want to limit it to 150 foot of right-of-way between each annexation, you could potentially go out and annex a lot that's within 150 foot. Then you'd have city boundary. You would once again extend 150 feet, and then you'd have city boundary. You could build up or down from that point in time. Pretty soon you'd have a little branch instead of a stem. This also could happen with contiguous annexations. For example, as you build out from your boundaries, and if it's a lot-by-lot type of development, you can eventually create a long stem or another block of annexations. So it seems to me when you put an arbitrary measure on things like 150 feet or so many lots or so many acres, you can't avoid creating some kind of crazy patterns. The reason crazy patterns occur is because it's the wishes of businesses to develop or the wishes of property owners to receive services. And everybody makes their own decisions in their own time. And what cities do is they respond to these wishes and they provide the services. And through this provision of services, the boundaries change. So unless you went out and annexed everything in one fell swoop out to your urban service boundary or urban growth boundary set by some state action, which currently is not allowed, I don't see how you can help but have an irregular pattern of growth, because people make decisions in different times in different ways. I would argue that it's the will of the people to dictate the timing at this point in the Oregon legislative session, and if it's the committee's wish, we'd be glad to sit down on a subcommittee to review annexation methods and work further on this. Do you have any questions of me?
I would just make this statement. We had an interim committee that functioned, and we scheduled three meetings, and we offered the opportunity to anybody to come in and resolve annexation issues that were basically unfinished business from this session. And we had nobody that was interested. And so that's why we end up with with some of these things. I mean, a cherry stem is not a new term to any of us on the committee last time. Non-contiguous, I had probably eight people come up to me on the floor during the annexation stuff last time and said, what do you mean that non-contiguous annexations are legal? Most people, I think, on the floor thought that they were not permitted. And so the opportunity was there to anybody who wanted to work at solving some of these problems, either perceived or real, and nobody answered the dinner bell. And so now we're dealing with them during the session again.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I guess, you know, one thing to conclude from that is that nobody thought it was a problem. But, and that's, I guess, my question for the witness. What do you see as the problem? Why would cherry stems be a problem?
I think the only problem possibly could be if the city was not able to serve it. And the city needs to examine the cost and benefit of serving an area. And that's their responsibility. If people want services and they think they can cost effectively provide them, then they should be allowed to get those services.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
So the effect of this bill, if it passed, would be if somebody came to you and asked to be annexed to the city of Portland, you'd have to say no. You can't have what you want because the legislature told you you couldn't do that.
That's correct, if it was outside the 150-foot limit.
Right. Mr. Chair.
Representative Seitz.
It seems to me that we need to draw a number of distinctions here. You've indicated that if people wanted to annex, they couldn't under this. Now, but I think you also said earlier that the city has not has not annexed non-contiguous territory.
Yes, sir.
All right. So if you're looking at, there's several issues here. One is the question of non-contiguous territory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, that gets a little fuzzy if you're talking about annexing up a street or right-of-way a long distance and you got something at the end of it. That's not technically non-contiguous, but it may, in fact, be that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. If you're looking at this, what you're saying is, I think that clearly under the way this bill is put together, you could do this, which also I think clearly indicates that annexation frequently is an irregular business.
Yes.
You can annex adjacent to a city, block, build on block, where that wouldn't be true. But this is very common, is it not? What you're doing is taking those people who want in and avoiding those people, if you can, who don't want in.
Yes.
And the nature of the annexation laws require you almost to do that, do they not?
Yes.
Now, if you've got an understanding or relationship with the districts as you do that, obviously that removes the war, the atmosphere of the war that you have, I think, in some of these other cases. But if you look at a map and say, all right, I want to annex a piece of property 2 miles away, not far-fetched, I think, if you look at some of these examples, and the people out there want city services from Eugene or Portland or wherever it is, and we'll go ahead and annex, which presumably if it's in the Boundary Commission, they've been, if not directly permitted by law, it's not excluded, precluded, and so they've been doing it. Isn't that quite a different matter than something like this, where you have no connection at all for fairly long distance? What's the impact on a non-contiguous piece of property to the adjacent service districts or units that provide service?
I think that would vary depending on the level of development of the adjacent territory realistically. If it was a fully developed territory and it was already served by existing special districts or perhaps a county district, then it'd be a rather large impact. If it's predominantly rural, it'd be minimal.
Let's say it's developed, but it's non-contiguous. In your judgment, do those districts have any right of what goes on? Do they have? Is there something that they ought to be that they can say to the city, we need somehow to consider this as well as your own interest?
I think they have a right to develop an agreement with the city and to balance the needs of both governmental entities to protect the interest of the people who are paying taxes within both districts.
I understand.
And I believe that a bill that you passed out of here last Thursday sets in place the structure in order to effectively have agreements with districts, and that's very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, just one comment. If somebody were not contiguous and wanted to join the city and we outlawed cherry stems or whatever, you could go to those people and say, go talk to your neighbors.
We do
and,
that.
And I would almost assume that you would do that anyway, that you would try to get as many folks to come into the annexation as is possible.
Mm-hmm. We do that, Chairman Young, but sometimes the person who wants to annex or the company that wants to annex might be a New York-based company wanting to locate in Portland or a business that has no interest in talking to their neighbors. If it's a residential area, I always ask them to go talk to their neighbors because it's, of course, better for the city, and it's residents inside the city who are currently paying for the services in a lot of different ways for that area already. It's better for them to bring as much territory as possible.
Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Thank
we'll
you.
Close the hearing on 3256 and open the hearing on 3397. You're talking about his chin?
Yeah. Something like that.
Welcome.
Well,
Good morning, or is it afternoon, or is it evening?
Yes.
Is this the non-lobbyist lobbyist?
Right.
I'm not Fred Neal, and I'm not the Intergovernmental Relations Officer for Moreland McKenna.
Have an identity crisis.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Fred Neal, Intergovernmental Relations Officer for Multnomah County. With me today is Larry Baxter, the manager of Multnomah County's Tax Title Unit in our Property Management Division of the Department of Environmental Services. And the bill before you, House Bill 3397, is a very simple bill, but it is part of a larger agenda that is of legislative and non-legislative issues that the City of Portland and Multnomah County have been addressing in a working group for some period of time now, and that's how to deal with the large number of vacant and abandoned buildings, not only inside the City of Portland, but within Multnomah County as a whole. This is a very small portion of that. There's at least seven bills dealing with the issue in what seems to be at least seven committees.
I'm sure we can spend more time on it than all the other committees combined.
I think the bill's fairly simple. It deletes the requirement that prior to the sale of a parcel of property in the tax foreclosure process, that it be independently appraised, or be appraised by a certified appraiser to simply determine what the market value of the property is. And in lieu of that, allows the county to use the assessed valuation, of the latest assessed valuation, as the indicator of market value.
Mr.
Baxter.
Representative Cease.
Let me ask you, Fred, because I think on the surface of this deal, it seems like a simple little bill.
thank you.
I didn't mean silly, because it's a real... But what happens in a situation where you got a piece of property that's 10 years out of date in terms of assessment?
Well, I think Mr. Baxter can answer that and tell you what the relationship of this market value price is to the whole tax foreclosure proceeding. I have distributed for the committee not only Mr. Baxter's written testimony, but also this memo that says Multnomah County Division of Assessment and Taxation on the front, a memo to me from Kathy Thunberg from RA&T Shop, but it's really the guts of it is a flow chart of the tax foreclosure process that the Department of Revenue has prepared. And it's explained to you just what the relationships are here of valuation of property and how they relate to the sheriff's sale process. Larry?
To answer, Larry Baxter, Multnomah County Tax Title Unit. To answer your question, a property that has been deeded to the county through tax foreclosure is still trended the same as other properties. So even though it's not taxable, it would have the same value as the other like properties, or it should have.
Well, I understand that, but I guess the question was if, since a number of the counties are out of cycle, you could have a group of properties that might be 10 years old in terms of...
issue of non-representative Cease... members of the committee, Fred Neal, the issue of non-compliance with the six-year appraisal cycle is primarily that of the physical appraisal, reappraisal. In off years, property, as a general rule, is trended along with the rest of the other 5 years to reflect the changes in the market. And so you don't really fall 10 years behind, even if you're 4 years behind in the physical reappraisal.
Well, I understand that, Mr. Chair, but let's say it was a expensive piece of property where there weren't a large number of like properties that were up for sale over a period of a number of years. It could be, in terms of actual value, out of value quite a bit, could it not?
To answer your question, the appraised value and the market value really have little to do with what we get as sheriff sale. And that's the main reason.
Yourself. I'm not sure that you
have. He did once.
Larry
yeah.
Baxter.
Okay. Sorry.
The reason for this is that the properties we have, obviously there's something wrong with them or we wouldn't have them. I mean, if the former owner could have kept them, they would have kept them. So to start off with, we're not talking about properties that have the same market value as like properties. When you offer a property to sheriff sale, under the current statute, there's no requirement that we set a minimum bid other than, you know, we can set it as low as we want. The current practice is, right now it's 50%. It could be, at one time we did 90% because we could get 90%.
Briefly, Mr. Chair, Representative Cease, the issue of appraised valuation versus the assessed valuation is simply in this statute looking for some indicator of market value that really does not relate to the price you get or even set as the minimum bidding price at the sheriff sale. We could actually do away with the requirement altogether. We are suggesting that at a minimum, please allow us to just use the assessed valuation, whether or not that's the property's been physically appraised or even trended. In some cases, for instance, in Multnomah County, we have not trended two of our six taxing districts in the last year or 2 years, I believe, because of conflicting sales data. There's been pluses and minuses, and so we just decided to not trend. Now we're trying to redefine those districts so that we can get better data. But that doesn't really dictate in any way, shape, or form what sort of price we get at the sheriff sale. As Mr. Baxter's written testimony says, when there's 50 to 200 bidders present at a sheriff's auction sale, you're going to get the highest bid price. You're not either going to get the market value or necessarily the back taxes plus interest plus cost of the sale.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Haas.
It seems to me that the best argument I've heard is that whatever you get at that auction is the market value, because there's no other way to determine the market to put it up to auction, it seems to me.
Well, Mr. Chair, let me ask it. I think the thing I'm trying to get at here is the value placed on the property, whether it's the assessed value or the appraised value, totally meaningless for purposes of the sale?
It's the advertisement, right? It's the notice. Mr. Chair, Representative Cease, I believe the purpose it serves here of some valuation is, if there is any, it would be found in the fact that this goes in the notice of the sale. So it gives people some sense of, I don't know, if you picked up the newspaper and you thought, well, I think I'll go to a sheriff's sale next week. Well, let's see what they got here. You get some sense of what perhaps the market value is, or, you know.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Mark.
Aren't some of these properties worth more if the junker was off of there than the lot? Than, I mean, some people are buying them and having to haul in their own wrecking crew. It costs some money to get them ready to do what they want with them.
Representative Martin, yes, that's true. In a lot of cases, we can get more money for them once the property's been taken off, or once the residence has been taken off.
Is this brought on some of this by the drug house problem, where they just walk away from a sack of junk and you can't touch it until you can foreclose on it?
That's true.
In the meantime, the neighborhood kids absolutely reduce it to ruin?
That's true.
And this doesn't really speed that up. It just takes away the requirement of an appraisal. Of an additional price.
That does reduce the time required to get it on to sheriff sale. We have two other bills as the county's complement of this vacant abandoned building, and we're using that phrase because it's more generic than calling them all crack houses, because they're not all crack houses, but they are attractive nuisances and need help. We also reduce the costs. Our appraisers, we're behind in compliance for the 6-year appraisal cycle, and so we've pulled off our in-house appraisers for tax foreclosed properties, and written testimony suggests, when we sought a bid for private contract for appraisal of these foreclosed properties, it came in at $125 to $225 a piece, and so it raises the cost. If we can reduce the cost of the sale, then it's reducing the cost of that property to a housing entity, public or private nonprofit that could rehabilitate that house and
Sure. Is there anybody, is a professional appraiser group going to come in to oppose this bill, or do you know?
We have not heard from them. You'd have to ask the committee administrator if they've if there's been any express opposition. We're not aware of any.
On this one?
No, nobody.
Well, we don't want to wear it out then, do we?
Yes.
Can you give me any idea of how many pieces of property you're talking about a year?
Yes. Larry.
Representative Cease. Right now we have 600 properties because we haven't been able to sell any. Normally we'll have about 200 or 300 in any year that we'll offer for sale. Some of those will carry over from year to year. We'll have about 100 new ones each year.
Does that money go into the general fund?
No, sir. That goes to the
unsegregated.
Yeah, the unsegregated tax fund.
Let me ask you, I would assume that if you have to do an appraisal, it's going to cost a little bit of money. You say about $125?
Yes, sir.
And it's inconvenient, it takes some time. Is there any indication that if you use the assessed value instead of an appraised value, that it would end up in less money per unit of for building over time?
No, there's no indication. I have a sale that the county commissioners are hearing today. We had it appraised a year ago at $70,000. We had it appraised again just a few months ago. It came in at $50,000. The top offer is $61,000. So, and the appraised value on the tax roll is $70,000. So it's not making any difference that I can see.
Mr. Chair.
Representative C.
I would say that I couldn't necessarily say this for Mr. Neal, but his colleague looks honest, talks honest, and he's answered all my questions. I think there's no problem with this bill.
Representative Hostica.
Well, actually, I would say the colleague looks honest, but listening to Mr. Neal, I think there is a problem, because if we put out an appraised value that's high, then some sucker will come in and think they're getting a break.
Mm-hmm.
And so the county might have an interest in making it look like they're giving people a bargain when they sell them a $50,000 piece of property for $61,000 because they think it's worth $70,000.
So. Well, I might just add that since this goes to the unsegregated tax account, and schools are the primary beneficiary of that, this is our small contribution to school finance reform.
Thank you, and we'll schedule. Representative,
we'll get a Mark. Comment if we see Fred bidding on one or two pieces, we'll know you're right.
and there's a 6 month or 1 year redemption after the sale.
A 2 year redemption period. That's another one of our bills.
After the sale?
No, sir. That's before the.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That's before we get it.
Yeah, but okay, but isn't there a 6 month after?
No, sir. There's no redemption. Once we sell it, it goes directly to the buyer.
All over.
And how much notice is given to the owner of record prior to the sale?
Altogether, about 7 years.
No, I mean prior to the date of the sale.
Okay, when we receive a property through tax foreclosure, he's already had a 2 year redemption period.
Okay, so you're talking about property that would have not had taxes paid on it since 81.
Right.
Okay.
I thought it was 1 year redemption.
Well, there's 1 year redemption on properties that are sold by a private interest holder. But those could be at a sheriff's sale, but there is no redemption after the sale.
If I could clarify that,
yeah.
When a property is sold for taxes, it's sold to the county. The county holds it for the 2 year redemption period.
And I thought that was 1 year.
It's 2 years now since the last legislature.
Okay.
We changed it to 4. Well, didn't we reduce it for the veterans' homes to 6 months, or what the hell did we?
Yeah, we didn't.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that still stand?
Right. I believe so.
The get the Bronner in here. He's the expert.
Yeah.
We got a variable rate here.
2 years.
Time rate.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing and open the public hearing on 3224. and call forward B.J. Smith. And anybody else. I see that we wore out the city of West Lynn and they've scratched their name in the program.
How much time did you allot this illustrious group?
Well, the less time they take, the better they're going to be.
I don't think they heard that.
No, they didn't.
Mr. Chairman, what I may do here is just explain this. I'm Jim Irvin. I'm a home builder from Portland. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Home Builders Association. And the four of us here today include representatives from the Home Builders Association and cities. And we're going to explain House Bill 3234 to the committee and hopefully be able to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Does the fact that they're all there mean they're all on the same side of this bill now?
That is correct, Representative Hostica.
Representative Markham?
Is this the same bill 2 years ago that a couple of mayors beat me up on when I got home?
No, Representative Markham, no, it is not.
Okay.
It's the same general concept.
It is the same subject. What we believe, this is a... we're going to present to you a statewide balanced approach to systems development.